Welcome to this latest edition of the Real Deal Podcast, The Wire Remix, Season 1, Episode 7, One Arrest. Of course, as always, I'm joined by one Robert Sapp. How you doing?
You doing well. How you doing?
Good.
Happy Mother's Day.
Absolutely.
To all the mothers out there.
There's a lot. Yep. To all, definitely happy Mother's Day to all the mothers out there. And to all the motherly-like figures out there.
There you go.
You know. Definitely hope they are enjoying that day on this Sunday. So this is episode seven, One Arrest. This episode was directed by Joe Chappelle, ranked by Vulture 41 all time in terms of Wire episodes, 41 out of 60. And the epigraph is, "A man must have a code," by one Bunk Moreland. So the opening scene, the detail is breaking down and decoding the wiretaps. They find out that through the decoding, they find out that they're anticipating a package being delivered by Stinkum. You have, of course, Prez and Freeman leading the way as far as breaking down these wiretaps. And even Perk gets in on the act as far as being able to decode what's being said on these wiretaps. Prez even uses a song that he used to listen to growing up to help him, which, you know, the detail looks down upon him, and, you know, basically says, you know, that explains a lot, as he was describing how he used to, you know, put the stereo next to his ear and listen to the same song or the same part of that song over and over again. A lot of details in this particular scene in terms of the type of discipline that it takes to do this type of work. And even, you know, they made fun of Prez, but I thought that part of the scene was important when he said, "Hey, I used to listen to the same song over and over again," which is in police work, and you want to do effective police work, wiretaps, it is repetitious, it is tedious, it is boring. So I think that message was well conveyed throughout this opening scene by the writers, David Simon, Ed Burns, and the creators of this show. What were your thoughts on this opening scene?
Yeah, I agree. I mean, it's very important. They're continuing to set up the rules of the Wire for us. And a big part of that is going to be a lot of redundancy, doing things over and over and over and over again, just to make sure that you got it right. So yeah. That's exactly what I took away from it as well.
So they go. So we move to Rawls and Santangelo. Rawls continues to pressure Santangelo about finding some Daryl McNulty. Santangelo, throughout the course of the season, continues to be reluctant to basically, you know, fuck over another cop. So Rawls, in classic Rawls fashion, says, "You know what? If you're not going to help me get Daryl McNulty, then you got to clear a case." Clearly, Santangelo is a mediocre cop, as well as mediocre homicide cop, because his clearance rate is low. And, you know, he basically says, he basically says these were some dunkers. And Rawls says, "Yeah, you had a lot of dunkers." So he says, "Pick one and clear it, or get me McNulty. He says that there's no third choice. So at this point, Santangelo picks out a case, and this leads on this wild goose chase where he gets involved with basically taken advantage of by Landsman and what have you with this psychic. Santangelo, maybe policing was just not his line of work. Santangelo was in the wrong line of work in terms of a career. It seems like he just doesn't have a clue.
Yeah, poor Santangelo.
feel so bad for Santangelo. Because Santangelo is not a bad dude. He's not somebody that you don't want to root for. But you know that this is just not his. Yeah, he's in the wrong game.
Yeah, I mean, like you got some detectives that detectiving is tricky for them.
And you know, the part of policing that he is doing is, you know, solving murders, which any cop will tell you how hard. I mean, this unsolved murder. There are thousands and thousands of unsolved murders throughout this country. Because I mean, it's not an easy task. That's why these detectives who are able to clear these cases are a few and far between. So when you have somebody like him who's mediocre, then those guys basically don't have a chance. I think this speaks, though, I think it, the big picture, it speaks of, and I think what they're trying to, the message that the writers are trying to send, or that Simon is trying to send is how much mediocrity is in the police department in general. How much deadwood, you know, guys just somewhat are collecting checks, even though, I mean, are collecting checks that just are not good at their jobs. So I think that they were trying to kind of send that message as well, even more so than having a boss like Rawls, who we know is a politician, who we know is going to do what's in the best interest of his unit.
Yeah, absolutely.
So the detail is going over the strategy in terms of how to bust Stinkum. They tell Hurricane and Carver, let the runner go. No, they tell Hurricane Carver to let Stinkum go and get the runner. The runner, of course, you know, was a young kid who Prez hit, you know, busted his eye. So they tell them, let the runner go. I mean, y'all two get on the runner. And we're gonna leave Stinkum, you know, we're gonna leave Stinkum be. Hurt was able to figure out that we'll have the charge on them anytime we want. What did you think about this particular strategy?
Yeah, I mean, like it's continuing the rule set up for what it has to look like. In particular, like the rules of engagement. It's continually setting up the idea that this is not just about, a little bit of coke on the table. Like an intense investigation like this requires a whole bunch. So that's one thing that it's doing. And then the second thing it's doing is it's letting us know how unique this investigation is. Because in a later scene that we'll talk about, that's what's so confounding to the Barksdale crew. They don't understand what's going on because this is such a unique investigative unit and is not following what they have experienced as normal procedure.
Also, you can talk about, you can kind of connect the tours even earlier, the scene where you have D'Angelo and the young boys in the pit with the chess scene where you can make moves in chess. Like, you always have to be thinking ahead. Like, yeah, they could take Stinkum and arrest Stinkum, but that's going to affect moves that they want to make further down the road.
So yeah, it's an absolute chess move
that they do.
Difference between investigation versus arrest. First, just going on and arrest. And what they're doing is they're investigating. They're not interested in just what, you know, kind of like what Herc and Carve called the Western District way, right? You just jump out and you just pound on somebody and you grab them up and whatever they're carrying, that's the arrest. And that's a good day's job. Not for an investigative unit. That's not what they're after.
So you have McNulty, Perlman, and Judge Phelan. McNulty and Perlman get Phelan to add 30 more days to the wiretaps. You have a situation where we find out that we find out that Phelan, of course, is attracted to Pearlman. And we find, and, you know, we also get dig deeper into the Phelan McNulty dynamic in that relationship. And I was curious to know or to wonder about what, about like, why does Phelan enjoy fucking with McNulty? Like, what's Phelan's motivation? He's a judge. They're, you know, McNulty's a cop. I don't think this is a political move for Phelan. I was always curious of why Phelan was even like had an interest in this case, had an interest in helping McNulty, and what have you. What were your thoughts on that?
I mean, if you like, so you got to let the episodes be your guide on this one, right? Like, so the initial beginning is McNulty has seen the Barksdale crew beat everybody in cases, in a murder case. And his way in on this, he figures, is the witness angle. But he knows he can't go to his bosses for that because they don't want it out there that they lose witnesses. So he goes to the judge. Him and Phelan had some previous relationship. I don't believe it's ever explained to us exactly what their previous relationship was, but you imagine it's something like what he has with Pearlman right now, minus the sex probably. And so he's a judge now, so he knows he can go to his judge. And so that's what kickstarts everything. That's what kickstarts everything else. I want to say, as of right now, it doesn't show that there's political motivation, but this episode just kind of cracked that door open. But we know there's, like, knowing the whole arc of the show, we know there's political motivations in pretty much everything that gets decided in The Wire, and particularly with Phelan. He wanted to be known. Anyway, it doesn't, like, that's for later shows. So that is actually there. And so at this point in time, what McNulty's frustrated at, which he does not have a reason to be frustrated, by the way, what he's frustrated at is that the judge keeps going to the press. And that's the political motivation. Like, that's the reason he keeps going to the press, is so that he can bang on the people that need, they can be negative towards the people he needs them to be negative towards. And if this thing comes, as McNulty said in this episode, becomes a career case, then he can take audit. Then he'll be the unnamed source. So he'll unreveal himself. If it's not, then it just remains what it is, which is why he doesn't ever reveal himself, as we'll see in further episodes. So anyways, yeah. I mean, I think it is a mutually beneficial relationship between McNulty and the judge. McNulty's using him, and the judge is using McNulty. McNulty has no reason to be upset.
No, he does. He really doesn't. Because Phelan helped McNulty, was the reason why McNulty was able to get this case moving. So no, he has zero reason to be upset at all.
Nobody here has righteous motives. So neither one, like, I'm not kicking up for either. No one has righteous motives in this. No one does.
No, it's not. No, this is not a situation where Phelan wants to help out the youth get drugs off the street. Like, this, he doesn't care like that. That's not, like, he feels a need. This is not Phelan feeling a need to do the right thing.
Yeah, I think my big point is they're both using each other. Yes. So it's a mutually beneficial relationship.
Stinkum, so you have Stinkum, Herc, Carver, Kima. They get Stinkum. Stinkum's in the car with the young boy from, of course, from earlier, the earlier episode, I think it was episode 2, where the one that Presbyluski busts his eye, he lost his eye, he has a patch over his eye. He's in the car, they go on this not high speed chase, but they chase him around the block, chase Stinkum around the block. The car, the boy jumps out of the truck with the G packs. He runs through the pit and eventually is chased down by Carver. Carver Hurk and Kima and Signor and Signor. Stinkum, of course, they let Stinkum go. Stinkum then goes to the payphone and calls and gets sends a page to Stringer's pager. Stringer returns the call. During this time, they let Lester know that Lester knows that this Lester sees this as Stringer's pager that's being called. He lets them know, and Signor goes to the runs to the rooftop to confirm that Stinkum is going to be calling Stringer back. So he calls Stringer back. They get on the phone. Stringer calls him. They get on the phone, and immediately Stinkum reveals that, you know, we lost 4 G-packs. Stringer reprimands him immediately, saying, "We don't know, you know, like, why the fuck are you telling me this over the phone?" And that's basically the end of that conversation. And they end up with the 4 G-packs. They arrest the kid, and of course they end up letting Stinkum go. What are your thoughts on this scene?
It's one of those things where we are getting to see the investigative process and getting to see why certain things are very meaningful. And so in this particular situation, it's showing us that the arrest is not the big thing right here. It's actually getting the information. And so Stinkum is much more valuable to the team, to the investigation, if he's out and about rather than running around. It's continuing to kind of like set up the rules for exactly what we're going to see in the future.
Yeah, and you know, they get to hear Stinkum on the phone with Stringer, and they, you know, Stringer again reprimands Stinkum for, you know, giving up that information as far as on talking over the phone in general, and just more confirmation about like how Stringer's involvement and what have you. So you get that information that they would not have gotten had they just outright arrested Stinkum. So you have Bunk and McNulty talking. They go to the place where Gant was shot, those apartments and what have you, and they find this lady who ends up helping her out with her groceries, and it ends up that the lady witnessed the murder. Now, she gives them part of it. She doesn't say that she basically gives them the murder, but she doesn't say that she saw Bird's face. She just says she saw him from behind, identified him, you know, being skinny, and basically described how far he was in terms of how far he was from Gant in terms of where he was going in terms of the shooting. So she gives up. They confirm that that this gives them confirmation that it was Bird, and they move forward from there. Do you want to add anything to that?
I think the biggest part of that sequence was that when they left the house, they didn't need her ID because McNulty had Omar.
Yeah. Johnny, Bubbles, and Kima. Johnny, of course, got busted in the last episode, so he's in court now. Bubbles gets Kima to help Johnny out. So Kima gets Johnny out. All he has to do is go to some meetings and they take some piss tests, some probation, no jail time. He gets him out. And again, another example of which will become a recurring theme of Bubbles bailing out Johnny and Bubbles just, you know, basically having this soft spot for Johnny, who is just a fuck up, to say the least. I mean, he's a crackhead and he's a fuck up. He's not even good at being a drug addict. And, you know, I'm going to touch on this later on in the episode about just destructive friendships, because this is one of them, without question. But anything about that scene that stood out to you?
I mean, like, the, you know, like, Johnny gets on Bubbles about, you know, being a snitch for the cops, but this is the fringe benefit of it, right? Like, that Bubbles can help out Johnny when he's in a little bit of jam. So even though John, I found it interesting, even though Johnny, that's the thing that he got on Bubbles about, that Bubbles is able to use that.
So you get back to the detail. They have the young man who was arrested with the re-up, Kevin. He immediately recognizes Prez from the towers that night. Prez recognizes him. They recognize each other, but Prez refuses to look him, you know, to even look at him eye to eye. Prez tells Daniels that's the guy, that's the kid. And then Daniels immediately goes and tries to flip the kid. And, you know, this was Daniels trying to, you know, obviously trying to further the case, but also more importantly, in a way, trying to give back. He has a conversation with the kid, basically saying the game has cost you. Daniels takes responsibility, takes responsibility for some of it. And he tries to give the kid a way out as far as, you know, he basically said, you know, how do you want to live the rest of your days? He gives him a soda and a peanut butter cup. And, you know, the kid recognizes the game right away. The kid calls out Daniels. Basically said, you know, motherfucker trying to pit me for a can of soda and some candy. And then he called Prez out, saying he can't even look me in the eye. But this is more about, to me, this is more about Daniels feeling like he owed something to this young man. What are your thoughts on this scene?
Yeah, this is one of those ones we got to dig a little deeper, because this is a big scene. I mean, for a lot of different reasons. I took Daniels as completely being genuine and that this actually had nothing to do with the case. In a very short way of saying, like, he felt bad that this happened. He felt bad that this happened on his watch. Then on another deeper level, you know, there are certain jobs, and I would imagine this would be one of them without not doing that, that are challenging, that is tough. You know, when you are a black man and day in, day out, you're watching black men kill each other, destroy their communities, destroy their own lives. That's tough. That's tough and that's hard. I think those two things compounded in this moment, or that at least that's what we're meant to believe in terms of, this was his people that did this to this young man, and this was another young man who in a long list of black young men he's seen, you know, go down self-destructive paths. There's another scene, a few seasons from now or whatever, maybe it was the next season, I can't remember. I do remember, it's when he's looking for the gun, next season. And Bunk like throws out a card to the people and is like, get out of jail free card for anything other than a homicide. No, it's when he's looking for Omar. When Daniels gave the kid the card, it wasn't about what he was trying to say was it wasn't about today. This is a chance to call me when you're at that point. Now, when I'm watching the scene, I'm also I know how tricky it's going to be, and how, you know, just at that moment in time, Daniels might as well be talking to a brick wall, because that kid hasn't suffered enough in order to be at that point where he'll be able to reach out for help for someone like Daniels, who clearly he sees as the enemy. You know, Barksdale clearly sees the police as the enemy. The community that's being policed by the police see them as the enemy, blah, 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 like all that stuff. And so the scene itself comes off as really, really tragically sad, because the likelihood of that kid ever using a card like that is very slim, and they don't even give you the opportunity. The scene writers, or the writers and the actors in the scene, don't even give you that opportunity, because the kid tosses that card away immediately. So it's a very meaty scene, and it's also one that's multi-layered and doesn't have an answer at all. Like, it doesn't even propose to have an answer. It's just showing you the reality of the situation that everybody's in.
Yeah. So Daniels, when he gives him that card, Daniels is doing this out of guilt. He's doing this because he does care, but he also knows in the back of his mind that this kid is not going to reach out for help, because he hasn't hit that bottom. Like, to your point, he hasn't hit that bottom yet. He's not even close to a bottom. He just got arrested as a juvenile.
Yeah, it's not about the kid. That's what's great about scenes like that. Each actor can play it for their part. So Daniels isn't playing this as, or the actor isn't playing this as, this is about what you're going to do. This is about the emotional impact of everything on Daniels, and Daniels reaching out. You know, sometimes most cases you're probably gonna get spit in your eye, but that's not the point. The point is that you put it out there. Now the person can do with it what they will, but he put it out there. If you need help, I'm here. Period.
Yes. So we go to Daniels, Marla, and Burrell at this gala, this party for cops and political figures. And clearly Daniels is out of his element. He's just there because his wife just kind of, I think, begins her political her making moves and things of that nature. This was for her. Burrell, he sees Burrell there. He speaks to Burrell at the party. And Burrell introduces him, which I thought was not, doesn't introduce him, but just shows him, basically tells him who's who. And we get to see Clay Davis. And even though Clay Davis didn't have any scenes as far as speaking scenes, Burrell tells Daniels who Clay Davis is, and this kid, who Clay Davis is, what he's about. And basically, Burrell was trying, you know, Daniels didn't know anybody in there. I saw it as Burrell sending a message to Daniels saying, a subtle message, maybe not through speaking, but basically saying, if you want to get ahead, you better get to know some of these people that are in this room. That's how I viewed it. That's how I viewed that part of the scene. What were your thoughts on that little on their interaction, and then and Burrell, and that whole environment that Daniels was in, seemingly being uncomfortable in that environment?
Yeah, no, it was a very, very cool little scene, because the writers and the producers and everybody involved are doing a couple of different things here, right? Like, A, they are, reaffirming what we already know about Daniels, or adding on to layers to the character of, you know, Daniels is not a politician. It doesn't come naturally to him, he's not a politician. Those are kind of like the character moments. We see that Burrell is a politician. He knows you can't get to his position without being a politician, and that he knows the game, and he's fully involved in playing that game. It also gives us a little bit of setup on Clay Davis, just kind of puts that nugget there, just right out there. So those are all the kind of like the initial plot point pieces that they're putting there. Just our character development pieces on different people that you either know or you're going to come to really know. The other big thing that they're doing is this is the first episode where they really kind of open the door to, or crack the door to, politics playing a role in the series. And so just as they kind of been setting the table, you know, this is one of the things we've always admired about The Wire that me and you have talked about and our circles always talked about, is how far ahead, how they were planning, to your point, playing chess, planning steps ahead. As we know, the political season doesn't happen until season 3, but here they are starting to crack in the middle of season 1. You know, a lot of shows might not, or other shows might not take the time to do that. Definitely not at this time. Would a show have taken the time to start building blocks towards what's going to happen in the future? So yeah, it was a very, very cool thing to watch.
So you have Bubbles and Johnny at this recovery meeting. They're going through this, you know, 12-step meeting. You're going through, they're giving out pins for 6 months recovery, 3 months recovery, 24 hours recovery. Bunk gets up for the 24-hour recovery or slash 24-hour recovery slash, or you want to get your life straight, get your life headed in the right direction. And Johnny, of course, again, chides Bubbles, saying, hey, we just got high this morning. What are you doing? And then we get introduced to Waylon, who gives what I would have to say, and this is the brilliance of this show. Because when I first saw this episode, or this even countless times seeing it, I completely just forgot about the depth and the power of this speech that Waylon gives about addiction. And you know, getting back to the scene that we talked about with the young kid, Waylon brings up, says, once you reach that bottom, then I'm there for you as far as you want some advice, something like that. Once you reach that bottom, we talked about in previous scenes about that young boy who got busted by the cops, nowhere near his bottom. And Waylon comes and says, hey, once you reach this bottom, then I'm going to be here for you. Here's the part of the speech that got to me. He says, now I know I got one more high left in me, but I doubt seriously I got one more recovery. Again, a very poignant and powerful scene when it comes to the, just showing you the meat of addiction and the process of addiction and the process of recovery and what addicts are going through, and you know, whether it be drugs, alcohol, gambling, whatever, just the power of addiction and the toll that is taken on a lot of these people, especially with him. And he goes through a story of, you know, he goes through his story. He doesn't give his whole complete story. He would give that later on. In further episodes later on throughout the course of the series. But he says, you know, he was out there, he had to pawn, he was pawning stuff, and he just scared off his wife, his family, and scared off, you know, just all this fucked up shit that's happened because of his addiction to drugs. And, you know, basically bears his soul through, you know, to a room full of strangers. I know you're going to have a lot on this. What were your thoughts?
No, not necessarily like a lot. I mean, because I think you pointed out exactly what the scene was doing, the juxtaposition of it. You have on one end, Daniel's offering support to the kid who, as you said, wasn't there. And then two things happen in this scene. It's introducing us to Waylon, as you said. Again, as I was watching this episode, I was like, this is a much slower episode because it's like taking its time to set up other things. Right. Which again, a lot of shows, particularly at that time, didn't do. And so it's introducing us, it's further giving us a look into Bubbles' life in a lot of different ways, which will reoccur and which will have consequences in the future. But it's laying those bricks and those foundations and giving us more parts of Bubbles. It's introducing an important character, Waylon, who we'll see. It's doing that, and then. On top of that, like you said, it absolutely, that's what I would have said. It mirrors the Daniel scene to T, except that he's talking to addicts and a lot of them have hit their bottom. So at the very least, maybe somebody will take him up on his offer because they're at a much different place than that kid was with Daniel. So you nailed exactly what I would have talked about.
He clearly gets the Bubbles. He has the attention of Bubbles at this point. He's not all, I mean.
Well, it's setting it up.
He has Bubbles' attention to an extent. Yep.
There's some type of connection. Bubbles can hear his story.
Yes. Daniel's Damian Price back at the party. Damian Price, AKA Ashy Larry.
Ashy Larry,
who's funny. Yeah, this dude's Ashy Larry is a stand-up and become like a top stand-up comedian. Like, who knew? And this guy, like, so his career really has blossomed since then. Outside of The Wire, they're in the kitchen and they're watching a baseball game. So Daniels is in there just want to kill time, basically watching the Orioles game. He's in the kitchen with a bunch of drivers. Damian Price happens to be one of the drivers, and Price basically is saying, you know, this is how much money is in the place, and how he would break in, and how much money, you know, he clearly doesn't know who Daniels is, and basically said, you know, how much money he can crack this, you know, I can crack this safe, the alarm system, and basically basically telling Daniels who he is as a criminal. And Daniels is just taking this all in and just listening. And then once they make an introduction, Daniels introduces himself as, they call me Damian. My name is Damian Price. They call me Day Day. Daniels says, my name is Cedric Daniels, but I go by mostly Lieutenant. So at that point, Price realizes he has put his foot in his mouth, and the scene concludes from there. What were your thoughts?
Yeah, so this is where I have a lot of thoughts on. Okay. Because this actually is where The Wire's genius. This is why this is a genius show. And it seems like this. Because the scene is completely played for laughs. In a lot of other programming, that's all this scene would be. It's like, ha-ha. Day-Day thinks he's talking to just a driver like him. What a fool he is. But the scene sets up so much. And this also is what I mean when I say there is no wasted motion in this show. And that's why it's brilliant. Here's a big thing. Another big thing, particularly for me and like my viewing habits, is show me, don't tell me. Show me, don't tell me. There are good scenes like the one that you talked about with Waylon, where he's giving a big, huge speech. But that's very much in the tell me frame. And you need those sometimes, the exposition. But I'm more impressed by scenes like this. And so by the sheer fact that Daniels is in that back room with everybody else talking about the game gives you way more detail about how uncomfortable he is than anything that he could have said or anybody else could have said, and how much he doesn't want to play the political game, or how much he doesn't see the political game. Because what allows Day-Day to feel that free to talk to him like that is because there would be no way a lieutenant would be back in that back room. There just wouldn't be a way, because that's not the purpose of that party. That's not how those people, that's not in his mind, in people's mind, that's not how they behave or how they will articulate or anything like that. So that just says a world about Daniels as a character, that he's back there and that Day-Day feels that comfortable with him. So that's point number one. The point number two is this is a huge moment, because this is going to crack open the whole notion of follow the money. This is the fact that Daniels has this interaction with Day-Day will be that light bulb in there and will create all types of havoc and drama for the detail in the entire future of The Wire, like the entire thing. This is the genesis of it right here. That scene right there is the genesis of it. And so that's what I mean by like, this is why this show is special. This is why this show is special.
And to add to that,
for scenes like this.
To add to that, if you're somebody who's new to this show, and you see a scene like that, and you're like, this is your first viewing of it, you might think to yourself, why the hell would Day-Day talk that freely? And even if he didn't know Daniels was a lieutenant, but still, why would he be comfortable with talking that freely? We're gonna find out in future episodes why he feels that comfortable with being that free in terms of how he was speaking. It might be viewed upon as a mistake, but there's a reason why he feels that comfortable with speaking, considering who he's working for, who he's connected to. There's a reason why he feels that comfortable with speaking that freely, why he feels that empowered. Like, why do you would think to yourself, why would a driver feel that empowered to speak like that? Because even though you don't know who Daniels is, and you might think he's a driver, you still don't. I mean, you don't say like, hey, I might think about breaking into this place, or even that's just dumb off the on the surface. But there's a reason why but again, we'll find out soon why he felt that empowered to speak to Daniels like that. So it was brilliant from that standpoint, because again, this, you know, yeah, that it was a quick scene. It was quick, but it was it definitely had a lot of layers to it. McNulty and Bunk at the bar, they both are drunk as usual in a bar when they get together. McNulty, basically Bunk is telling McNulty what he's going to have to do to get back in the good graces with Walls. You know, give him some clearances, kiss some ass, and go from there. And then they get into this dialogue where you find out the origins or the genesis of their friendship. And basically, without getting into the dialogue word for word, basically, I took it as, it seems to me like nobody else was fucking with McNulty and Bunk. You know, Bunk was the first guy that kind of like, they were kind of kindred spirits to begin with when McNulty first started being a cop at that, you know, at the Western District and what have you. And McNulty, like McNulty is thankful that Bunk took him kind of under his wing when maybe nobody wanted to fuck with him, or maybe he didn't know anybody else. So that's what I kind of took that as. But I have some more later about this friendship that's just not good for either one of them. And down the road, further in the episode, what were your thoughts on this scene?
Yeah, I I wanted to take a step back just really quickly. What you said in the last scene, in terms of like, it was a short scene, but there was a lot in there. I could literally do that with every single scene in The Wire. Like everything I did in that last one, I could pick up those exact same things from a scene like this. I just have to pick and choose for time-wise. So there's equally a ton in a scene like this, but I'm gonna be much shorter and briefer on this one. I agree with you, and then I'm gonna add more. It's like a mentor-mentee relationship, and we'll see it juxtaposed a little bit, like when Bunk talks to Omar at kind of towards the end of the, or no, at the actual end of the episode. Bunk is just years ahead of McNulty, and yeah, mentor-mentee relationship. That's the part that I would add on. McNulty looks up to Bunk, because Bunk was there before him and showed him how to get there.
Yeah. No, there's no question that he views him, and they share some of the same destructive qualities, which I will touch upon later in this episode, later in the show. So you have D'Angelo, Avon, Stringer, Stink, and Weebe. D'Angelo enters the club. Before he heads upstairs, Orlando pulls him aside and basically says he wants to speak to him later on about a move that they can make. This is the beginning of the end for one of Orlando. Put a bookmark next to that, to that conversation. We'll get to that later on. D'Angelo heads upstairs. He's in a room with Avon, Stinkum, and Weebe. Avon, of course, is, you know, upset about basically saying, ask him, you know, basically what's going on, who's snitching. D'Angelo explains, you know, basically tells him, hey, my crew is tight. I did everything that Stringer told me to do as far as cracking them with the money situation, with holding out. And Avon, you know, D'Angelo questions Stinkum about, you know, running a traffic light, and, you know, Stinkum, you know, rebuffs that, saying, you know, I definitely wouldn't run a traffic light with 40 G's, $40,000 worth of stuff in the car. So at this point, this is where Avon, getting back to earlier scenes we talked about, this is where Avon is baffled, not understanding why they would let Stinkum go, why they wouldn't arrest Stinkum, and why they would let Stinkum go. So he decides to change things up. We don't find out at that particular scene, but we'll find out later. He gives, lets D'Angelo know that the pit is shut down for the time being, and Stringer will be coming around with some more details on what they're gonna do. This is the first time that you really see them baffled about what's going on. Like, for the first time, the police have thrown them for a loop, and they can't understand, because they're used to the police taking the shortcuts, they're going for the chasing stats, busting heads. They're used to that, the Mickey Mouse stuff that the cops have been doing in the past. This was a chess move that the police made that they were not ready for, and that they did not anticipate. So what were your thoughts on this scene, from the Orlando part to the conversation upstairs?
Yeah, I mean, I took a lot from the conversation upstairs, in particular after D'Angelo had left. And to your point, this is the first time that it doesn't, like, things that are happening are not making sense. They're looking outside of, you know, oh, is this just a snitch or somebody in your crew? And so, yeah. That the like they they're as careful as they possibly can be, and still these things are happening. And now things that normally cops do, they're not doing. So this also, it just kind of like, it, like when you talk about, like, you use the chess analogy a lot of times today, like, you know, it's just like, all right, now your opponent is doing something unexpected. What are they doing? So now I liked it because it was just kind of like, it showed it's starting the process of showing the skill of Avon, in particular, that the wheels are now turning in another direction that wouldn't necessarily have been turning before, because it would have been something that's part of the game. He's starting to sense this is something different. So I really like that. I really like seeing kind of like, you know, it's not just, as we know, it won't be this, but this is kind of like laying that foundation of, this is not just the cops get their man type of show. They're very much adversaries, and they're very much playing against each other. And so you make a move, then I make a move. You make two or three moves, I figure out what you're doing, now I have to counter. So this is the beginning of Avon thinking about what's going on, and just what's going on, and then eventually that'll come with countermeasures.
So you have Bubbles and Johnny getting high. And again, it's Bubbles continually, you know, one step forward, two steps back, down this road where he feels like, I mean, he enjoys getting high, but I also think part of me feels as if though he is doing this for Johnny as well. Like, he, you know, I guess it's one of those situations where you know something is not, you know, you do something with a friend and a friend brings out destructive behavior in you. When you know in your heart of hearts, this is not the right thing to do. That's what it felt like.
You're being way too kind to Bubbles right now.
You think so?
Oh, definitely. You're being way too kind to Bubbles. Bubbles is an addict. He wants to get high.
He does. Yeah, he does want to get high.
He don't have anything to do with Johnny.
Yeah, he does want to get high. But they this shows them getting high. We go to...
That doesn't invalidate what you're saying in terms of they're bad for each other.
They are bad for each other. They're terrible for each other.
Yeah.
He's an addict. He's still an addict.
Yes, he is. He wants to get high.
McNulty, Daniels, Kima, and Bunk, they talk about going after Bird. You have them plotting on terms of how they're going to go after Bird. Then you have Omar, McNulty, and Kima looking for Bird in the pit. They're in the car. And Bird, Omar is basically giving a scouting report on Bird, you know, where he cops, where, you know, what type of gun he has, where he goes to get, you know, where he goes to get a gun, where he goes to cop drugs, his demeanor, you know, hit the rules of the Barksdale, saying, you know, never get, he quotes the Biggie song, Ten Crack Commandments, never get high on your own supply, saying that they're not allowed to get high in the pit, but he does get high. So he gives all this information up on Bird. He gives all this information up on Bird, and the thing that jumps out again, how well he knows Bird, how well he knows the Barksdale operation, and the fact that he has zero fear, because somebody can easily spot him in that car. They're not inconspicuous. They're right there. He could care less. Like, Omar could absolutely care less, and he messages that anybody I have a problem with, I'll stick my gun in their face. What were your thoughts on Omar's just knowledge of the Barksdales and where he's at this point, as far as, you know, snitching on Bird and their whole crew?
This is another really good scene. There's a lot going on in this scene. So in a lot of our reviews, we go back to the epigraph a lot. So this is the time where I'll go back to the epigraph. A man has to have a code. And so you're using the word snitching, and under the definition, this is absolutely what snitching is. But I know Omar views this very, very, very differently. Barksdale's crew went past, in his opinion, what they should have done to his boy. And it was somebody that he cared about and loved. And so there's a whole bunch of revenge in that. So in Omar's mind, or in the way that he's acting, he's not afraid because he has his reputation, but also because this isn't something that he doesn't feel like he can back up. He doesn't feel violates his code. He's not with the police just to take out anybody. He's with the police to get Bird. Because Bird is who Bird is to him. And Barksdale's who's Barksdale. Also, this is a callback to how self-destructive the actions of the Barksdale crew was, and how this will continuously, their reaction to Omar and what they did to Brandon is going to lead to their ultimate downfall in a variety of ways. And this is a big way, that they have someone with the stature of Omar who can see the street as well as Omar, who is on their side. They don't do to Brandon what they did. Omar's not doing this. No way, no way. He's not doing anything like this. So this is another piece of the Barksdale crew, how they've assured their own destruction in a move like this. And then on top of that, I mean, like Omar just kind of like gives them this is valuable pieces of information for Kima and McNulty to download just in their own internal investigating process. Everybody knows don't get high on your own supply, but what Omar's saying is people are still going to get high. So this is how I would track him, which is very different than how the police would track him. And so in order to get somebody like a Bird in a Barksdale organization, you have to think differently. You just have to think differently. The normal police way of thinking about these things isn't going to apply, which is a theme that runs throughout the entire run of The Wire. So they do a really good job of showing that in this. In this scene.
And he tells them, now he might have said this in the previous episode, but I believe he over some point over the last couple episodes, he told them if they do catch him, he definitely will have the same gun because he's too trifling to throw it off.
He said that multiple times.
He said so that is definitely important. It was definitely important information leading up to them getting Bird. We go to Bodie and Pooh in the pit. Bodie and Pooh are talking about Wallace. Wallace hasn't showed up for work in a couple of days. First, Bodie asked Pooh where Wallace been. So Bodie's antennas are already up about Wallace from that standpoint. And Pooh basically says he's been up in his room all day, still fucked up behind, you know, the Brandon killing and what have you. And of course, we would later see Wallace up in the room getting high. And this was basically, I shouldn't say the beginning and the end for Wallace, because really the beginning and the end for Wallace was seeing that body. But this is where the Wallace story arc goes, gets ramped up that much more. Pook and Bodie are talking about him, and then later on, of course, we see Wallace getting high in his room, trying to cope with what he saw with that murder. Then you see Wallace. You see Orlando going into the pit, and he's to speak to D'Angelo about a connect that he's met. The connect was from, you know, you met the connect, you know, in D.C. He has the connects, gets the stuff straight out, you know, straight from New Orleans, and they Orlando gives him presents him with this offer saying that, we can go 50-50. I just need somewhere to distribute it. And D'Angelo doesn't agree to the offer, but he agrees to listen, you know, let me think on it. You know, let me think on it. He doesn't say, hey, we're gonna do this. Just let me think on it. Now again, the beginning of the end for one Orlando, moving forward. What are your thoughts on these two parts to this critical scene?
Yeah, I'm gonna be brief on this because the plot points are fairly obvious of what's going on. I'll say, because I agree with everything that you said. I'll say the other thing that I noticed was I heard this in another podcast that was talking about The Wire, but like Bodie's always very deferential to Stringer. It has been at the point in time. Whereas to the rest of his crew, and particularly to D'Angelo, he's super dismissive. So I was really watching Bodie in this scene, and I know what the setup is in terms of what you're talking about with Wallace. But what I also noticed was Bodie clocking Wallace's whereabouts and what he's doing. And I would also contend that Bodie sees what's going on and will use Wallace to further his own career in the Barksdale organization. I hadn't really thought about that until this rewatch and watching Bodie's reaction to everybody, and then watching Bodie particularly in this scene. I don't think it's a mistake that he's saying, where's Wallace and what's up with Wallace? And of course, ultimately knowing the end, viewing this through as Wallace was Bodie's way in to a different position in the organization, or at the very least, getting noticed by Stringer Bell. So I was really clocking that. But everything else you said was absolutely on point in terms of the different plot points that were there.
So you have the detail casing Bird. Bird, of course, was copping some drugs. Copping some drugs, he gets out. Then you have Bubbles, the whole setup. You have McNulty and Daniels in the car, Kima there in the car. They have him surrounded, front and back. You have Bubbles putting the red hat on Bird when he walks out of the and he recognizes him immediately. Freeman and Sidnor come out to the liquor store. Freeman knocks hits him in the head with a bottle, and they arrest him, and Hurt comes out late and says, I got the legs after about five cops are on him. So they take down Bird. Just show you how well thought of the plan was. I mean, the plan was executed flawlessly. It was like being a sports person, I am. It was almost like if a coach draws up a play for a game-winning shot, and then they execute it to a T. That's how this was. I mean, everybody played their part. Everybody to a T. It was just well executed, and it just amazed how many cops came out, just showing you how dangerous they thought Bird was. And it was about at least six or seven cops that came out once they jumped out on him. But just a flawlessly executed plan, and using Bubbles and had the decoys as far as Freeman and Signor, how they played their roles. What were your thoughts on how they took down Bird?
Yeah, I mean, like, I don't have much to add. I think your analogy was spot on. The only thing that I'll say is they didn't think. They knew because Omar told them.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, they had the answer to the test. Like, yeah, no, this was Omar gave them the answers to the test. You have Stringer, Wiebe, D'Angelo. Stringer and Wiebe head down, and Bodie. Stringer and Wiebe head down to the pit. Wiebe and Stringer are questioning D'Angelo, asking him, has he followed this move? Has he followed that move? And, you know, D'Angelo has an answer for all those questions. And then Stringer stares at the payphones and orders Wiebe to tear out the payphones. I just wonder at what point did Stringer make that assessment, or was that right on? Did he make that assessment as he's staring at the payphones?
It was part of the plan, okay, that they discussed in the room.
Okay.
It wasn't spur of the moment.
Okay. So this was premeditated. This is him. Yeah. This is Avon. This is basically him Avon telling him, following what Avon told him to do.
Yeah.
Okay. So they tear out the payphones, and they order D'Angelo and Bodie to use different phones, walk, you know, a couple blocks, use phones, and then don't use the same phone twice. So they have, you know, they have the attention of the police. Clearly have the attention. They make their chess move, and back at the detail, you see Freeman recognizing that the service has been interrupted, interrupted with the tearing out of the payphones. What were your thoughts on this scene?
Move, counter move. That's kind of like that. That's my big takeaway. It's like, from the investigation standpoint, it's gonna feel like, oh wait, what's happening? Like this is really bad. And from Barksdale, they're just going way, way past careful. So neither one will know what the other, or at this point in time, know why certain things are happening, but they're happening because of the moves that the other person is making. So it's again going back to that chess match, move, counter move. On that, I also thought the Freeman makes a point. I don't think it's in this season. It might have been in this season. No, it's not in this season. Makes a point of where he talks about the discipline of it. And that's what I always love when I think about like the different moves that the characters in the show are making, is just like the things they continue lean back on are, you know, in Wiebe's words, way past careful. I just think about that. Like, you got to walk blocks and you can't use the same phone twice. That's a lot to ask of somebody. But that's the type of discipline that's needed to play this game well. Anyways, I always find that interesting. It's always one of the things I think about.
Yeah, and you go back to you go back to episode 5, a little slow, a little eight, a little late. Avon, in that opening scene, tells Wiebe, I used this phone yesterday. I'm not going to use this phone because I used this phone yesterday. So he was on that even before that, before this episode. He was already on that, on that program, so to speak. I still think they were, like, testing D'Angelo, too, with the questioning. Did you get that sense?
I think Stringer is always testing D'Angelo. That's what I'll say. I think it's not an accident, writing wise, that we get the sense of D'Angelo that we do. And definitely everyone outside of Avon has that same sense of D'Angelo, that this game is not for him.
So you have the Bird interrogation. They get Bird handcuffed in the interrogation room. Lanceman comes in, takes a picture, and, you know, Bird cusses him out. And then Kima comes in. He goes, he insults her, calls her, you know, a dyke cunt and all this other stuff, goes at her. And, you know, and then you have McNulty gets the match from the gun. The ballistics came up that matched his gun to Gant. And, you know, basically giving Bird a chance to talk. Bird, throughout the whole scene, refused, of course, does not say anything to incriminate the Barksdale organization. He's a soldier. He's not gonna say anything. So they decide to basically, between Daniels, Lanceman, Kima decide basically to beat the shit out of him. Daniels tears up the picture. Daniels, Lanceman, and Kima in the room. McNulty wasn't in the room. It was Daniel, Lanceman, and Kima in the room, and they beat the shit out of them. And then you have, at the same time, you have Omar and Bunk talking. And, you know, Omar says, Bird knows how to get it out of people. And you have getting Omar to basically give him murders going back to from years past. And again, an example on how well Omar sees and knows the street. Omar is able to recognize Bunk from way back. They went to the same high school. Bunk was older than him. And he recognizes him from the fact that he played lacrosse. And Bunk apparently was a great lacrosse player in high school. They make that connection. They're both from the same high school, from the same part of the area. So that connection is made. And Bunk uses the epigraph phrase, a man must have a code, and, you know, to Omar, and Omar responds, indeed. So Bunk gets what he wants as far as using Omar to get to clear some cases. Omar gets what he wants as far as Bird suffering, as, you know, Bird being one of the people that of course helped torture and kill Brandon. What were your thoughts on these two parts of this particular scene?
Yeah, this is another one where it's just like, I'm just gonna go in a little bit, because it's so good. Because again, the scene with Bird is played for laughs. Like, it's supposed to be comical the entire way around, or that's how it can be viewed, right? Bird's in there, he's cursing everybody out. They rip up the picture and they beat him up, right? Like that, so that's the first part. That's the first one I'm gonna tackle. And the reason why it's such a good scene is because the important piece of the police gain important piece of information in this. And the important piece of information is that that no matter how high, the higher up they go, the least likely they are to get a potential case made, get somebody to flip over on them, which is something that they'll use again and again in talking about, like, why they need these high end investigations to happen. It's because there's not going to be anybody that's going to flip over, even though they're threatening with death penalty and everything like that, and the amount of years, and this is all going to go on you. He knows the gun is dirty and everything like that. So that's just such a major component of The Wire. And this again is the genesis of it. There's nothing that they're going to be able to do to get Bird to turn in. And go states, which is why wire investigations and things like this are needed. It's just absolutely why. So it's essential. That scene is an essential thesis of the show. If that's how big that scene is. So that's part one. You know, the like literally like scenes like with the Bunk and Omar scene deserve an entire season of commentary. Like that's how huge I find scenes like that. And the reason, because it's what he's showing you, or what the scene is showing you, is it's all about relationships. It's another central thesis of Simon and Burns, the creators and writers and executive producers on the show, and then by extension, a lot of the people that they hire and get involved with. There's a little bit more research and stuff that I've done in knowing like the crew behind the scenes, but specifically, you don't have to dig. Like, all you have to do is Google David Simon, like his thoughts on The Wire. And one of the big points is about knowing your environment, knowing the people you're policing, knowing the place that you're in. And so the connection between Omar and Bunk going to the same school, meaning they're from the same neighborhood. They grew up in the same areas. They know the same people. They know the same haunts. They've walked each other's shoes, and because each of them have taken different paths in life, doesn't take that away. And so in that statement where Bunk is like, oh, seeing as you're being in such a generous mood or giving mood, he can only say that because they've made that connection. And so, because when Buck first started off the conversation, he was starting off like, yeah, this is where I also did service. This is where I also was a policeman. And Omar's like, nah, that's not what I'm talking about. And so that's how Buck is able to get that extra amount of information to him, which will then play huge at the end of the season and then actually play huge in what does and doesn't happen to McNulty. This simple interaction. And it's based off the only reason Omar's even in the police station is based off the relationship that McNulty is able to build with Omar. So that, I mean, that's essential. Three central theses come out of this scene, these scenes in the show. One being, you know, that wire investigations are essential to police work because. And if you want to play the long-term big drug game, just flipping people is not going to work. Two is relationships are everything. And three, in order to be effective in any area that you're doing, you got to know the city and you got to know the people.
Yeah, I mean, they make that connection. And it goes back to, again, what you're saying about what real policing looks like, as far as what, and Kima says something she was trying to tell Herc and Carver earlier in the season about McNulty and Kima having a conversation about how effective a good CI is, and how, you know, seeing and McNulty saying, you know, describing the dude that saw the eyes, who saw the street like no other. That's all through relationships. Like, it's not, that's all through making connections with relationships, no matter criminals or whether they're criminals or not, or drug dealers or not, or, you know, even with, you know, Bubbles and what have you, that's all through developing relationship development. So from that standpoint, yeah, that was a brilliant scene. That whole interaction with Bubbles and Omar. And again, they both get something that they wanted at the same time too.
And again, I cannot overestimate this. The sheer brilliance and genius of The Wire is that they show, they don't tell. So whereas another situation, another show, another whatever, would have stopped at the speech about this is how you develop, this is why snitches are so important, or having a confidential informant is so important, and this is why they're important. And of course, the guy that saw the street, like Omar, then they show you what building that relationship with Omar looks like. They show you how they do it, and then they show you the effects of it and how big it is and why nothing moves forward without a good confidential informant. So not only did they give you the statement earlier on in the season, but then they show you and they back it up.
Yes. McNulty and Santangelo. So McNulty, through one of the murders that that Omar gave Bunk, it clears one. It was a connection to one of Santangelo's cases. It cleared. So they, because of that information, they clear a case for Santangelo. So McNulty, Santangelo was thinking that, you know, it was the gypsy or it was the psychic, and Lansman basically says, you know, fuck the psychic. It was these guys that cleared your case. This leads McNulty, Santangelo, to let McNulty know that Ross has it in for him, that Ross is his intentions. And then we see McNulty, of course, in the episode, going to Perlman's house, letting them know that, you know, they're going to do them. I want this case, and they're going after my badge. And that is where the episode ends. What were your thoughts on that ending scene, as well as the Santangelo part of this?
I have so many, thoughts. So here's how I'm going to start it, since we're at the end of the episode. Santangelo is actually my MVP of this episode.
Okay.
And so the reason, I'll just be really quick. The reason why he's my MVP is because he did a lot of the comedic relief heavy lifting in this episode. Right. And because he goes through an emotional arc in this episode and up until that point in time. Now, remember at the beginning where Santangelo's like, you got to cover for me, I got to do something, right? Like, that's supposed to lead us into the comedic relief of him talking to the psychic. But it also speaks to what we've also seen. Santangelo's never around. And the reason why Santangelo's never around is because he doesn't want to see anything that McNulty's doing, because he doesn't want to be a dirtbag and say right. anything to Ross. So Santangelo has actually been the angel on McNulty's shoulder this entire time. But the way McNulty reacted at the beginning was, you know, a-hole, whatever he said about him, even though Santangelo has been doing this for the entire season. Santangelo's not a hump like the other guys were. So I heard you at the beginning going in on Santangelo. It is hilarious because he's like on a dunker. From Raw's perspective, you get 7 out of 10 of them correct. And again, like I said, he took a lot of the heavy lifting in terms of the comedic emotional abuse of it, but he's actually been doing the right thing the entire time. He's been doing the absolute right thing the entire time. He's not giving up one of his brothers. Would I say he's a great cop? No. Would I say he's a hump? Absolutely not. He's just an average police guy. He does really well with things he can do really well with. And the Stone case, no whodunits are the ones that are the hardest for everybody to clear. So that's part one. The second part of that is just kind of like the emotional weight in which that got carried with that scene. Because it's like there are two parts to it. One is because of the work that both Bunk and McNulty, and this is why I'll give McNulty credit because I'm about to shit on him as well. Because of the work that he's done developing Omar as a confidential informant, he's able to clear cases that others wouldn't normally be able to clear. That's what makes McNulty McNulty. That's what he's lauded for. We talked last episode about how he did that in some manipulative, messed up ways, but whatever. He's doing the job that he's assigned to do. where I'm going to get on him this week is, what did he expect was going to happen? Like, that's the attitude of a child. Whereas I can piss off anybody I want to, play by my own entire rules, and there be no consequences to those actions.
Right.
You can't irritate, backstab, you know, cross your direct supervisors, your bosses of bosses in this case, and then not expect them to go after your badge. So I found it disingenuous that he's showing up at Ronnie's door talking about, oh, woe is me, they're going to go after my badge. Like, what did you expect was going to happen? But in lieu of that, with all of that, the way in which it is revealed to him, I love the way in which they did it through Santangelo actually giving him the real on what Rawls wanted for him.
So he never snitches on Jimmy, on McNulty throughout the whole season. The one time he spoke about McNulty in previous episodes, he basically told Rawls, all the dude does is, you know, go after cases, basically. All he does is work. So, yes, to your point, he never snitches. He never tells Rawls. He never gives Rawls anything. And, yes, that it was brilliant by the writers to have him continuously disappearing because he doesn't see anything. And he's willing to take a case that he knows he cannot solve for his brother. He knew he couldn't solve that case, that whatever case Rawls gave him the pick. He knew he couldn't solve that case.
So Rawls
knew he couldn't solve that case.
It was a lot of cases
that weren't clear, that he didn't clear. So he's willing to take, like, I think, you know, there was a recurring theme throughout this episode about codes. He has a code that he was going to upheld his code as far as not telling on his brother. It definitely, you had Omar going past, you know, you spoke on it earlier, saying that being willing to tell on the Barksdales because he felt like they broke a code, in terms of what they did to his boyfriend. So you had that going on in regards to codes throughout the course of the episode. And of course you had Bird violates multiple codes and pays the price for it. He's getting high, number one, and he doesn't toss off a gun. So Bird violates those codes where getting high in general and not tossing off that gun that ends up being a match to the Gant case. So those were recurring themes. That was definitely a recurring theme throughout the course of the episode. I want to get to this friendships viewpoint, because I'm looking at Bunk.
Wait, real quick, who's your MVP? You never say who your MVP was.
I would say between Freeman and Prez, with that code breaking, because that broke open a lot of shit in regards to them getting stink on with the G-Packs. That leads to the Barksdales switching shit up. And now they know, even though they rip out those payphones and that temporarily hurts the investigation, now the cops know we got their attention and we've made a dent. So now it's game on now from that standpoint. So I have to go between Omar. I was about to say Omar. Omar was, because Omar gave up a lot of information too. But that code, I thought that them breaking that code and getting those G-packs in and having that situation, I thought that was the biggest piece to me. So I would say Freeman and Prez from kind of split the MVP vote.
Nice.
But again, that's the beauty of The Wire. There could be a lot of MVPs in terms of how deep these scenes go and how layered these scenes are. The friendship thing. So you have Bubbles and Johnny, Bunk and McNulty. I can make a case that none of those four should be around each other. And I'm going with Bunk. The easy thing would be Bubbles and Johnny because they're both crackheads. That'd be easy. That's easy. But in terms of Bunk and McNulty, you have two great cops who are high level detectives, but they bring out the worst of each other from a personal standpoint of self-destructive behavior. It just so happens that Bunk is able to navigate manage his self-destructive behavior better than McNulty, but they're not good for each other. Like, even up until this point, they're not good for each other at all to me. From a personal standpoint, not from the cop, but from a personal standpoint.
But so you want to talk about Bunk and
I just wanted to address the whole, destructive friendships. Like how, we've been there before as far as in our lives over the course.
Yeah. I like where you were going in terms of like Bubbles and what's young boy's name? Why am I blanking on that?
Johnny.
Yeah. And McNulty and,
Bunk.
And kind of like what we were talking about last episode, it's just you can't separate any of these characters. No one is over the other one. So it might be a little bit easier to identify because Bunk and Jason use drugs, but you know, Jimmy, alcoholic, both of them are cheating on their wives constantly. Those are pretty identifiable self-destructive behaviors as well. There isn't a difference in between the groups. So I absolutely agree with you there. It's complicated because in both of these groups, there's a mentor-mentee relationship.
Yes.
That is involved. Yes. And that's a little bit different than just friendship, in my eyes. When it is on that, kind of like that mentor-mentee relationship, it usually falls on the mentor to be a more of the bigger person and kind of shine the guiding light. For them. And then I think to your point, what each of the mentors in this case, Bunk and Bubbles, what they look for in their mentees are the things that that they enjoy outside of the main attraction. Bunk and McNulty, it's a socially acceptable job, which is being a law enforcement agent. And for Jason and Bubbles, it's much less socially acceptable, which is being a drug addict. But what I mean by the other activities for Bunk, McNulty's his wingman out and about. And he'll always be the one who'll do something crazier than him. And so that takes a little bit of the pressure off him outside of the office. And for Bubbles, Johnny's always one that he's going to be able to save. He's always going to be somebody that's going to need him. Somebody that he will need the way that his brain works in creating a caper that will actually work and not get him in trouble. And so, yeah, it's complicated.
This is why I want to get into it. It's very complicated. It is not cut and dry. Like the cut and dry aspect would be like, all right, so I'm around this person, but I know that they are bad for me. And if I separate myself from this person, then everything's gonna be good within myself in terms of my choices and my actions. We know that's not the case in these two situations. We know that even Bunk and McNulty were not around each other, they both would still be cheating on their wives. They still would be alcoholics. We know if Bunk and Johnny wasn't around each other, they still would both be crackheads. So it's not as simple as, well, they just shouldn't be around. They would be better off apart. It's nowhere near being that cut and dry. And like to your point, the mental aspect takes it to a whole nother level, because you know we've all had mentors in our lives. We know the value of that relationship. So like somebody who's a mentor to you, you know you look up to this person, you value their advice, you feel like they're leading you down the right path. That's an important relationship in general. So you're not gonna see a Johnny just like push away Bubbles. So you're not gonna see, of course, you're not gonna see McNulty just move on from Bunk. And somewhat vice versa, even as the mentor. I mean, because there's something there. There's a kindred. They are all four of those guys, all four of those characters in ways are kindred spirits in terms of how they think, how they act, how they behave, even though they're somewhat different. McNulty is not, I mean, Bunk is not as reckless and nowhere near as reckless as McNulty is more, and Bunk will look out for his own best interests. Bunk is not gonna fuck himself over to do some of this shit. He's not gonna go as far as McNulty.
So, and McNulty, I mean, he's the one who said in the epigraph, a man has to have a code. Bunk right. has a code.
Yes, Bunk has a code, yes. But I just think that it's just brilliant of the show to how they balance that, those relationships with the friendships and the mentors with the deconstructive, but the destructive behavior. That was the overall just point that I wanted to get into when it came to these two particular relationships. And it jumped out in this episode too. I've never seen this episode, I don't know how many times, it never dawned on me until I watched it again. That's the brilliance of this show. You just pick up new stuff episode in, every time you rewatch it. Every time you rewatch it, you see something that is new. So I had Prez and Freeman as my MVPs. Again, this episode overall setup is a lot going on as far as what you're gonna see in future episodes, not only this season, but they set up some stuff that will take you out throughout the course of this series, to be honest, up into season five, with that political stuff. So that this was definitely, it seems like we say this every week, but this definitely was a pivotal episode in terms of some moments that you saw. You mentioned them. One, the Damian Price, Daniels interaction, and then also the Bunk and Omar relationship.
Yeah.
I think we covered everything there, covered everything in terms of the episode. As always, thank you, Rob Seth, for joining me.
Appreciate you, sir.
And look forward to next episode, and also the Jordan documentary episode 7 and 8. This is supposed to be great. This, everybody's hyping up these next two episodes to be great. So we'll see.
Hope it's great.
All right, man. Take it easy.
All right. Have a good one. Happy Mother's Day to your mom.
Yep. Same to yours, man.
Later.
That, of course, was Robert Sapp joining me, doing a always tremendous job at deconstructing and deep diving this show. And again, this is the greatest show ever. It's the greatest show ever. Like, I can't rewatch these episodes enough. I mean, to be honest with you, I mean, you can rewatch that Wire thousands of times. It's that brilliant of a show, because you're gonna find there's some new meat on the bone every single time, every single time. So that's gonna wrap it up for this latest edition of the Real Deal Podcast. We have a full week, of course, coming up. I will do game three. I'm going to do game six of the 97-93 NBA Finals, Phoenix-Chicago. We'll do that later on in the week. And, of course, later on in the week, I will look back at episode 7-8 of the Jordan documentary, Last Dance. So stay tuned for that. As always, this is your host, Surreal Gerald Quinn. You can find this podcast on iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, Blog Talk Radio, of course, my YouTube page, and so I'll have this episode out early tomorrow morning. Have a great rest of the evening. Happy Mother's Day to all the mothers all over the world. I'm out.